And from then on, she and Edouard, my father-in-law, always introduced me as Bertrand's wife. I looked down at the blue line. A baby. A baby! A feeling of joy, of utter happiness took over. I was going to have a baby. I glanced around the all-too-familiar kitchen. I went to stand by the window and look down at the dark, grimy courtyard the kitchen gave onto. Boy or girl, it didn't matter. I knew Bertrand would hope it was a son, but he would love a girl, too. I knew that. A second child. The child we'd been waiting for so long. The one we had stopped hoping for. The sister or brother Zoe had given up mentioning. That Mamay had stopped being so curious about. How was I going to tell Bertrand? I couldn't just call him and blurt it out on the phone. We had to be together, just the two of us. Privacy, intimacy was needed. And we had to be careful after that, not letting anyone know until I was at least 3 months pregnant. I longed to call Hervé and Christophe, Isabelle, my sister, my parents, but I refrained. My husband was to be the first to know. Then my daughter. An idea came to me. I grabbed the phone and dialed Elsa, the babysitter. I asked her if she was free tonight to watch Zoe. She was. Then I made reservations at our favorite restaurant, a brasserie on the Rue Saint-Dominique we had been to regularly since the beginning of our marriage. Finally, I called Bertrand, got his voicemail, and told him to meet me at Tumieux at 21 hours sharp. I heard the click of Zoe's key in the front door. The door slammed, then she walked into the kitchen, her heavy backpack in her hand. "Hi, Mom," she said. "Good day." I smiled. As ever, like every time I laid eyes on Zoe, I was struck by her beauty, her slender height, her lucid hazel eyes. "Come here, you," I said, engulfing her in a wolfish embrace. She pulled back and gazed at me. "This has been a good day, hasn't it?" she asked. "I can feel it in your hug." "You're right," I said, longing to tell her. "It has been a very good day." She looked at me. "I'm glad. You've been weird lately. I thought it was because of those kids." "Those kids?" I said, brushing her sleek brown hair from her face. "You know, the children," she said. "The Valdiv children. The ones who never came home." "You're right," I said. "It made me sad. It still does." Zoe took my hand in hers, twisting my wedding band round and round, a trick she had since she was small. "And then I heard you talking on the phone last week," she said, not looking at me.
"Well?"
"You thought I was asleep."
"Oh," I said.
"I wasn't. It was late. You were talking to Hervé, I think. You were talking about what Mamay had told you."
"About the apartment?" I asked.
"Yes," she said, looking at me at last. "About the family who lived there, and what had happened to that family, and how Mamay lived there all those years and didn't seem to care much about it."
"You heard all that?" I said. She nodded.
"Do you know anything about that family, Mom? Do you know who they were? What happened?"
I shook my head.
"No, honey, I don't." "Is it true that Mamay didn't care?"
I had to be careful.
"Sweetie, I'm sure she did care. I don't think she really knew what happened."
Zoe twisted the band around again, faster this time.
"Mom, are you going to find out about them?"
I clasped the nervous fingers, pulling at my ring. "Yes, Zoe, that's exactly what I'm going to do," I said.
"Papa won't like it," she said. "I heard Papa telling you to stop thinking about it, to stop bothering about it. He sounded mad."
I pulled her close, laying my chin on her shoulder. I thought of the wonderful secret I carried within me. I thought of tonight at Tumieux, Bertrand's incredulous face, his gasp of joy.
"Honey," I said, "Papa won't mind. I promise."
Exhausted, the children at last stopped running, ducking behind a large bush. They were thirsty, out of breath. The girl had a sharp pain in her side. If only she could drink some water, rest a bit, get her strength back. But she knew she couldn't stay here. She had to move on. She had to get back to Paris. Somehow. "Take off the stars," the man had said. They wriggled out of the extra clothes, torn and tattered by the barbs. The girl looked down at her chest. There it was, the star, on her shirt. She pulled at it. Rachel, following her glance, picked at her own star with her nails. Hers came off easily. But the girl's was too tightly sewn on. She slipped out of the shirt, held the star up to her face. Tiny, perfect stitches. She remembered her mother, bent over the pile of handiwork, sewing on each star patiently, one after the other. The memory brought tears to her eyes. She cried into the blouse with a despair she had never known. She felt Rachel's arms come around her, her bloody hands stroking her, holding her close. Rachel said, "Is it true about your little brother? Is he really in the cupboard?" The girl nodded. Rachel held her harder, stroked her head clumsily. Where was her mother now, the girl wondered, and her father? Where had they been taken? Were they together? Were they safe? If they could see her at this very moment, if they could see her crying behind the bush, dirty, lost, hungry. She drew herself up, doing her best to smile at Rachel through her wet lashes. Yes, dirty, lost, hungry perhaps, but not afraid. She wiped her tears away with grimy fingers. She had grown up too much to be afraid anymore. She was no longer a baby. Her parents would be proud of her. That's what she wanted them to be. Proud because she had escaped from that camp. Proud because she was going to Paris to save her brother. Proud because she wasn't afraid. She fell upon the star with her teeth, gnawing at her mother's minute stitches. Finally, the yellow piece of cloth fell away from the blouse. She looked at it. Big black letters. Jew. She rolled it up in her hand.
"Doesn't it look small, all of a sudden?" she said to Rachel.
"What are we going to do with them?" said Rachel. "If we keep them in our pockets, and if we are searched, that's the end of us."
They decided to bury their stars beneath the bush with the clothes they had used for their escape. The earth was soft and dry. Rachel dug a hole, put the stars and clothes inside, then covered them up with the brown soil.
"There," she said, exulting. "I'm burying the stars. They're dead. In their grave. Forever and ever."
The girl laughed with Rachel. Then she felt ashamed. Her mother had told her to be proud of her star. Proud of being a Jew. She didn't want to think about all that now. Things were different. Everything was different. They had to find water, food, and shelter, and she had to get home. How? She didn't know. She didn't even know where they were. But she had money, the man's money. He had not been that bad after all, that policeman. Maybe that meant there were other good people who could help them too. People who did not hate them. People who did not think they were different. They weren't far from the village. They could see a signpost from behind the bush.
"Bon la Hollande," read Rachel out loud.
Their instinct told them not to go into the village. They would not find help there. The villagers knew about the camp, yet nobody had come to help, except those women, once. And besides, the village was too close to the camp. They might meet a person who would send them right back there. They turned their backs on Bon la Hollande and walked away, keeping close to the tall grass by the side of the road. If only they could drink something, thought the girl. She felt faint with thirst, with hunger. They walked for a long time, pausing and hiding when they heard an occasional car, a farmer taking his cows home. Were they going in the right direction? To Paris? She didn't know. But at least, she knew they were heading farther and farther away from the camp. She looked at her shoes. They were falling apart. Yet they had been her second best pair, the pair for special occasions like birthdays and the cinema and visiting friends. She had bought them last year with her mother, near the Place de la République. It seemed so long ago, like another life. The shoes were too small now, they pinched her toes. In the late afternoon, they came to a forest, a long, cool stretch of green leafiness. It smelled sweet and humid. They left the road, hoping they might find wild strawberries or blueberries. After a while, they came upon an entire thicket of fruit. Rachel uttered a cry of delight. They sat down and gobbled. The girl remembered picking fruit with her father when they had spent those lovely days by the river, such a long time ago. Her stomach, unused to such lavishness, heaved. She retched, holding her abdomen. She brought up a mass of undigested fruit. Her mouth tasted foul. She told Rachel they had to find water. She forced herself up, and they headed deeper into the forest, a mysterious emerald world dappled with golden sunlight. She saw a roe deer canter through the bracken and held her breath with awe. She wasn't used to nature. She was a true city child. They came to a small, clear pond farther into the forest. It was cool and fresh to their touch. The girl drank for a long time, rinsed out her mouth, washed away the blueberry stains, then glided her legs into the still water. She had not gone swimming since that river escapade, and didn't dare enter the pond completely. Rachel knew and told her to come in. She'd hold her. The girl slipped in, grasping Rachel's shoulders. Rachel held her under her stomach and her chin, the way her father used to. The water felt wonderful to her skin, a soothing, velvety caress. She wet her shaved head, where the hair had started to grow back, a golden fuzz, rough like the stubble on her father's chin. All of a sudden, the girl felt drained. She wanted to lie down on the soft green moss and sleep, only for a little while, only for a quick rest. Rachel agreed. They could have a short rest. It was safe here. They cuddled close to each other, reveling in the smell of fresh moss, so different from the stinking straw of the barracks. The girl fell asleep quickly. It was a deep and untroubled sleep, the kind she hadn't had for a long time. It was our usual table, the one in the corner on the right as you came in, past the old-fashioned bistro zinc bar and its tinted mirrors. The red velour banquette formed an L. I sat down and watched the waiters bustling about in their long, white aprons. One of them handed me a cure royale. Busy night. Bertrand had taken me here on our first date, years ago. It had not changed since. The same low ceiling, ivory walls, pale globe lights, starched tablecloths. The same hearty food from Corrèze and Gascogne, Bertrand's favorite. When I met him, he used to live on the nearby Rue Malard, in a quaint rooftop apartment that was to me unbearable during summer. As an American raised on permanent air conditioning, I had wondered how he put up with it. At that point, I still lived on the Rue Berthe with the boys, and my dark, cool little room seemed like heaven during the stuffy Parisian summers. Bertrand and his sisters had been raised in this area of Paris, the genteel and aristocratic 7th arrondissement, where his parents had lived for years on the long, curving Rue de l'Université, and where the family antique shop flourished on the Rue du Bac. Our usual table. That's where we had been sitting when Bertrand had asked me to marry him. That's where I told him I was pregnant with Zoe. That's where I told him I had found out about Amélie. Amélie. Not tonight. Not now. Amélie was over. Was she, though? Was she really? I had to admit I was not sure. But for now, I did not want to know. I did not want to see. There was going to be a new baby. Amélie could not fight against that. I smiled, a little bitterly, closing my eyes. Wasn't that the typical French attitude, closing your eyes on your husband's wanderings? Was I capable of that? I wondered. I had put up such a fight when I had first discovered he was being unfaithful 10 years ago. We had been sitting right here, I mused, and I had decided to tell him then and there. He had not denied anything. He had remained calm, cool, had listened to me with his fingers crossed under his chin. Credit card slips. Hôtel de la Perle, Rue des Canettes, Hôtel Lenox, Rue de l'Ambre, Le Relais Christine, Rue Christine. One hotel receipt after the other. He had not been particularly careful, neither about the receipts nor about her perfume, which would cling to him, his clothes, his hair, the passenger seatbelt in his Audi station wagon, and which was the first clue, the first sign I recalled. L'heure bleue, the heaviest, most powerful, cloying scent by Guerlain. It wasn't difficult finding out who she was. In fact, I already knew her. He had introduced her to me right after our marriage. Divorced. 3 teenage children. 40-ish, with silvery brown hair. The image of Parisian perfection. Small, slender, perfectly dressed. The right handbag and the right shoes. An excellent job. A spacious apartment overlooking the Trocadéro. A magnificent old French name that sounded like a famous wine. A signet ring on her left hand. Amélie, Bertrand's old girlfriend from the Lycée Victor de Ruy, from all those years ago. The one he had never stopped seeing. The one he had never stopped fucking, despite marriages, children, and the years going by. "We are friends now," he had promised. "Just friends. Good friends." After the meal, in the car, I had transformed myself into a lioness, fangs bared, claws drawn. He had been flattered, I suppose. He had promised, he had sworn. There was me and only me. She was not important. She was just a passade, a passing thing. And for a long while, I had believed him. And recently, I had begun to wonder. Odd, flitting doubts. Nothing concrete. Just doubts. Did I still believe him?
"You're crazy to believe him," said Hervé, said Christophe.
"Maybe you should ask him outright," said Isabelle.
"You're out of your mind to believe him," said Charla, said my mother, said Holly, Susanna, Jan.
"No Amélie tonight," I decided firmly. "Just Bertrand and me and the wonderful news." I nursed my drink. The waiters smiled at me. I felt good. I felt strong. To hell with Amélie. Bertrand was my husband. I was going to have his baby. The restaurant was full. I looked around at the busy tables. An old couple eating side by side, one glass of wine each, studiously bent over their meal. A group of young women in their 30s, collapsing with helpless giggles as a stern woman dining alone nearby looked on and frowned. Businessmen in their gray suits, lighting up cigars. American tourists trying to decipher the menu. A family and their teenage children. The noise level was high, the smoke level too, but it didn't bother me. I was used to it. Bertrand would be late, as usual. It didn't matter. I had had time to change, to have my hair done. I wore my chocolate brown slacks, the ones I knew he liked, and a simple clinging fauve top, pearl earrings from Agatha, and my Hermès wristwatch. I glanced in the mirror on my left. My eyes seemed wider and bluer than usual. My skin glowed. Pretty damn good for a middle-aged pregnant female, I thought. And the way the waiters beamed at me made me think they thought so as well. I took my agenda from my bag. Tomorrow morning, first thing, I had to call my gynecologist. Appointments needed to be made fast. I probably had to go through tests. An amniocentesis, no doubt. No longer was I a young mother. Zoe's birth seemed so far away. All of a sudden, panic hit me. Was I going to be able to go through all this 11 years later? The pregnancy, the birth, the sleepless nights, the bottles, the crying, the diapers? Well, of course I was, I scoffed. I had been longing for this for the past decade. Of course I was ready. And so was Bertrand. But as I sat waiting for him, anxiety grew. I tried to ignore it. I opened my notebook and read the recent Veldiv notes I'd taken earlier on. Soon, I was lost in my work. I no longer heard the hubbub of the restaurant around me, people laughing, waiters moving swiftly through the tables, chair legs scraping the floor. I looked up to see my husband sitting in front of me, observing me. "Hey, how long have you been sitting there?" I asked. He smiled. He covered my hand with his.
"Long enough. You look beautiful."
He was wearing his dark blue corduroy jacket and a crisp white shirt. "You look beautiful," I said. I nearly blurted it out right then. But no, this was too soon, too fast. I held back with difficulty. The waiter brought a cure royale for Bertrand.
"Well," he said, "why are we here, amour? Something special? A surprise?"
"Yes," I said, raising my glass. "A very special surprise. Drink up. Here's to the surprise." Our glasses clicked.
"Am I supposed to guess what it is?" he asked.
I felt impish, like a little girl. "You'll never guess. Never." He laughed, amused.
"You look like Zoe. Does she know what the special surprise is?"
I shook my head, feeling more and more excited. "Nope. No one knows. No one except me." I reached out and took one of his hands. Smooth, tanned skin. "Bertrand," I said. The waiter hovered above us. We decided to order. It was done in a minute. Confit de canard for me, and cassoulet for Bertrand. Asparagus for starters. I watched the waiter's back retreat toward the kitchens, and then I said it, very fast. "I'm going to have a baby." I scrutinized his face. I waited for the mouth to tilt upward, the eyes to open wide with delight. But each muscle of his face remained motionless, like a mask. His eyes flickered back at me.
"A baby?"
he echoed. I pressed his hand. "Isn't it wonderful? Bertrand, isn't it wonderful?" He said nothing. I couldn't understand.
"How pregnant are you?"
he asked finally. "I just found out," I murmured, worried by his stoniness. He rubbed his eyes, something he always did when he was tired or upset. He said nothing. I didn't either. The silence stretched out between us like mist. I could almost feel it with my fingers. The waiter came to bring the first course. Neither of us touched our asparagus. "What's wrong?" I said, unable to bear it any longer. He sighed, shook his head, rubbed his eyes again. "I thought you'd be happy, thrilled," I continued, tears welling. He rested his chin on his hand, looked at me.
"Julia, I had given up."
"But so had I, completely given up." His eyes were grave. I did not like the finality in them. "What do you mean?" I said. "Just because you had given up, then you can't..."
"Julia, I'm going to be 50 in less than 3 years."
"So what?" I said, cheeks burning.
"I don't want to be an old father," he said quietly.
"Oh, for God's sake," I said. Silence.
"We can't keep this baby, Julia," he said gently. "We have another life now. Zoe will soon be a teenager. You are 45. Our life is not the same. A baby would not fit into our life."
The tears came now, splashing down my face into my food.
Are you trying to tell me?
I choked.
Are you trying to tell me that I have to get an abortion?
The family at the next table stared overtly. I did not give a damn. As usual, in times of crisis, I had reverted back to my maternal tongue. No French was possible at a moment like this.
An abortion? After 3 miscarriages?
I said, shaking. His face was sad, tender and sad. I wanted to slap it, to kick it. But I could not. I could only cry into my napkin. He stroked my hair, murmured over and over again that he loved me. I shut his voice out. When the children awoke, the night had fallen. The forest was no longer the peaceful, leafy place they had wandered through that afternoon. It was large, stark, full of strange noises. Slowly, they made their way through the bracken, hand in hand, pausing at every sound. It seemed to them the night grew blacker and blacker, deeper and deeper. They walked on. The girl thought she was going to drop with exhaustion, but Rachel's warm hand encouraged her. They at last came to a wide path weaving across flat meadows. The forest loomed away. They looked up at a somber, moonless sky.
Look, said Rachel, pointing ahead of her. A car.
They saw headlights shine through the night, headlights that were darkened with black paint, only letting a strip of light through. They heard the noisy engine approaching.
What shall we do? Said Rachel. Shall we stop it?
The girl saw another pair of overshadowed headlights, then another. It was a long line of cars coming closer.
Get down,
she whispered, pulling at Rachel's skirt.
Quick!
There were no bushes to hide behind. She lay flat out on her stomach, her chin in the dirt.
Why? What are you doing?
Asked Rachel. Then she, too, understood. Soldiers. German soldiers, patrolling in the night. Rachel scrambled down next to the girl. The cars drew near, powerful engines rumbling. The girls could make out the shiny, round helmets of the men in the muted light of the headlights. They are going to see us, thought the girl. We cannot hide. There is no place to hide. They are going to see us. The first jeep rolled by, followed by the others. Thick, white dust blew into the girls' eyes. They tried not to cough, not to move. The girl lay face down in the dirt, her hands over her ears. The line of cars seemed endless. Would the men see their dark shapes by the side of the dirt road? She braced herself for the shouts, the cars stopping, doors slamming, fast footsteps and rough hands on their shoulders. But the last cars went by, droning in the night. Silence returned. They looked up. The dirt road was empty, save for clouds of billowing white dust. They waited a moment, then crept down the path, going in the opposite direction. A light shimmered through trees, a white beckoning light. They drew nearer, keeping to the sides of the road. They opened a gate, walked stealthily up to a house. It looked like a farm, thought the girl. Through the open window, they saw a woman reading by the fireplace, a man smoking a pipe. A rich smell of food wafted by their nostrils. Without hesitating, Rachel knocked on the door. A cotton curtain was pulled back. The woman who looked at them through the glass pane had a long, bony face. She stared at the girls, pulled the curtain back again. She did not open the door. Rachel knocked again.
Please, madame, we would like some food, some water.
The curtain did not move. The girls went to stand in front of the open window. The man with the pipe got up from his chair.
Go away,
he said, his voice low and threatening.
Get away from here.
Behind him, the bony-faced woman looked on.
silent.
"Please, some water," said the girl.
The window was slammed shut. The girl felt like crying. How could these farmers be so cruel? There was bread on the table. She had seen it. There was a pitcher of water, too. Rachel dragged her on. They went back to the winding dirt road. There were more farmhouses. Each time the same thing happened. They were sent away. Each time they fled. It was late now. They were tired, hungry. They could hardly walk. They came to a large, old house, a little off the dirt road, lit by a high lamppost shining down on them. Its facade was covered with ivy. They didn't dare knock. In front of the house, they noticed a large, empty dog shed. They crept inside. It was clean and warm. It had a comforting, dog-like smell. There was a bowl of water and an old bone. They lapped up the water, one after the other. The girl was frightened the dog might come back and bite them. She whispered this to Rachel. But Rachel had already fallen asleep, curled up like a little animal. The girl looked down at her exhausted face, the thin cheeks, the hollow eye sockets. Rachel looked like an old woman. The girl dozed fitfully, leaning against Rachel. She had a strange and horrible dream. She dreamed of her brother, dead, in the closet. She dreamed of her parents being hit by the police. She moaned in her sleep. Furious barks startled her awake. She nudged Rachel, hard. They heard a man's voice, steps coming closer. The gravel crunched. It was too late to slip out. They could only hold on to each other in despair. "Now we are dead," thought the girl. "Now we are going to be killed." The dog was held back by its master. She felt a hand grope inside, grasp her arm, Rachel's arm. They slithered out. The man was small, wizened, with a bald head and a silver mustache.
"Now what do we have here?"
he murmured, peering at them in the glare of the lamppost. The girl felt Rachel stiffen, guessed she was going to take off, fast, like a rabbit.
"Are you lost?"
asked the old man. His voice seemed concerned. The children were startled. They had expected threats, blows, anything but kindness.
"Please, sir, we are very hungry," said Rachel.
The man nodded.
"I can see that."
He bent to silence the whining dog. Then he said,
"Come in, children. Follow me."
Neither of the girls moved. Could they trust this old man?
"Nobody will hurt you here," he said.
They huddled together, fearful still. The man smiled a kind, gentle smile.
"Genevieve!"
he called, twisting back to the house. An elderly woman wearing a blue dressing gown appeared in the large doorway.
"What is that idiotic dog of yours barking at now, Jules?"
she asked, annoyed. Then she saw the children. Her hands fluttered to her cheeks.
"Heavens above,"
she murmured. She came nearer. She had a placid, round face and a thick white braid. She gazed at the children with pity and dismay. The girl's heart leapt. The old lady looked like the photograph of her grandmother from Poland. The same light-colored eyes, white hair, the same comforting plumpness.
"Jules,"
the elderly lady whispered.
"Are they?"
The old man nodded.
"Yes, I think so."
The old lady said firmly,
"They must come in. They must be hidden at once."
She waddled down to the dirt road, peered both ways.
"Quick, children, come now," she said, holding out her hands. "You are safe here. You are safe with us."
The night had been dreadful. I woke up puffy-faced, with lack of sleep. I was glad Zoe had already left for school.
I would have hated for her to see me now. Bertrand was kind, tender. He said we needed to talk it over some more. We could do so that evening, once Zoe was asleep. He said all this perfectly calmly, with great gentleness. I could tell he had made up his mind. Nothing or no one was going to make him want me to have this child. I couldn't bring myself to talk about it yet to my friends or to my sister. Bertrand's choice had disturbed me to such an extent that I preferred to keep it to myself, at least for the time being. It was difficult to get going this morning. Everything I did felt laborious. Every movement was an effort. I kept having flashbacks of last night, of what he had said. There was no other solution but to throw myself into work. That afternoon, I was to meet Franck Lévy in his office. The Veldive seemed far away all of a sudden. I felt like I had aged overnight. Nothing seemed to matter anymore. Nothing except the child I carried and that my husband did not want. I was on my way to the office when my cell phone rang. It was Guillaume. He had found a couple of those out-of-print books I needed concerning the Veldive at his grandmother's place. He could lend them to me. Could I meet him later on in the day or that evening for a drink? His voice was cheerful, friendly. I said yes immediately. We agreed to meet at 6 o'clock at the Select on the Boulevard de Montparnasse, 2 minutes away from home. We said goodbye, and then my phone rang again. It was my father-in-law this time. I was surprised. Edouard rarely called me. We got on in that French polite way. We both excelled at mutual small talk. But I was never truly comfortable with him. I always felt as if he was holding something back, never showing his feelings, to me, or to anybody else for that matter. The kind of man one listens to. The kind of man one looks up to. I could not imagine him showing any other emotion apart from anger, pride, and self-satisfaction. I never saw Edouard wearing jeans, even during those burgundy weekends when he would sit in the garden under the oak tree reading Rousseau. I don't think I ever saw him without a tie, either. I remember the first time I met him. He hadn't changed much in the last 17 years. The same regal posture, silver hair, steely eyes. My father-in-law was overly fond of cooking and was constantly shooing Colette away from the kitchen, turning out simple, delicious meals. Pot-au-feu, onion soup, a savory ratatouille, or a truffle omelet. The only person allowed in the kitchen with him was Zoe. He had a soft spot for Zoe, although Cécile and Laure had both produced boys, Arnaud and Louis. He adored my daughter. I never knew what went on during their cooking sessions. Behind the closed door, I could hear Zoe's giggle, and vegetables being chopped, water bubbling, fat hissing in a pan, and Edouard's occasional deep rumble of a chuckle. Edouard asked how Zoe was doing, how the apartment was coming along. And then he got to the point. He had been to see Mamet yesterday. It had been a bad day, he added. Mamet was in one of her sulks. He had been about to leave her pouting at her television, when all of a sudden, out of the blue, she had said something about me. And what was that? I asked, curious. Edouard cleared his throat.
My mother said that you had been asking her all sorts of questions about the Rue de Saint-Ange apartment.
I took a deep breath. Well, that's true, I did, I admitted. I wondered what he was getting at. Silence.
Julia, I prefer that you don't ask Mamet anything about the Rue de Saint-Ange.
He spoke suddenly in English, as if he wanted to be perfectly sure I understood. Stung, I replied in French. I'm sorry, Edouard. It's just that I'm researching the Veldive Roundup at the moment for the magazine. I was surprised at the coincidence. Another silence.
The coincidence? He repeated, using French again.
Oh, well, yes, I said. About the Jewish family who lived there just before your family moved in, and who were arrested during the roundup. I think Mame was upset when she told me about it, so I stopped asking her questions.
Thank you, Julia, he said.
He paused.
It does upset Mame. Don't mention it to her again, please.
I halted in the middle of the sidewalk. Okay, I won't, I said. But I didn't mean any harm. I only wanted to know how your family ended up in that apartment, and if Mame knew anything about the Jewish family. Do you, Edouard? Do you know anything?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that, he replied smoothly. I must go now. Goodbye, Julia.
The line went dead. He had puzzled me to such an extent that for a brief moment, I forgot about Bertrand and last night. Had Mame really complained to Edouard about my questioning her? I remembered how she had no longer wanted to answer me that day. How she had shut up, not opening her mouth once till I had left, baffled. Why had Mame been so upset? Why were Mame and Edouard so intent on me not asking questions about the apartment? What did they not want me to know? Bertrand and the baby came back down on my shoulders with a heavy weight. All of a sudden, I couldn't face going to the office. Alessandra's curious gaze. She would be inquisitive, as usual. She would ask questions, trying to be friendly, but failing. Bamber and Joshua glancing at my swollen face. Bamber, a true gentleman, would not say a thing, but would discreetly squeeze my shoulder. And Joshua, he would be the worst.
Well now, Sugar Plum, what's the drama? The French husband again?
I could almost see his sardonic grin handing me a cup of coffee. There was no way I could go to the office this morning. I headed back up toward the Arc de Triomphe, picking my impatient but deft way through the hordes of tourists walking along at a sluggish pace, gazing up the arch and pausing for photos. I took my address book out and dialed Franck Lévy's association. I asked if I could come now, and not this afternoon. I was told there was no problem. Now was perfect. It wasn't far, just off the Avenue Hoche. It only took me 10 minutes to get there. Once off the engorged artery of the Champs-Élysées, the other avenues springing out from the Place de l'Étoile were surprisingly empty. Franck Lévy was in his mid-60s, I guessed. There was something profound, noble, and weary about his face. We went into his office, a high-ceilinged room filled with books, files, computers, photographs. I let my eyes linger over the black-and-white prints hung on the wall. Babies. Toddlers. Children wearing the star.
Many of these are Veldiv children, he said, following my gaze. But there are others, too. All part of the 11,000 children deported from France.
We sat down at his desk. I had emailed him a couple of questions before our interview.
You wanted to know about the Loiret camps, he asked.
Yes, I said, Bonne-la-Hollande and Pithiviers. There's a lot more information available about Drancy, which is nearer to Paris, much less on the other two.
Franck Lévy sighed. You're right. There's little to be found about the Loiret camps compared with Drancy. And you'll see when you go there, there's not much there that explains exactly what happened. The people who live there don't want to remember, either. They don't want to talk. Also, there were few survivors.
I looked again at the photos, at the rows of small, vulnerable faces. What were these camps in the first place? I asked.
They were standard military camps built in 1939 for imprisoning German soldiers. But under the Vichy government, Jews were sent there from 1941. In 1942, the first direct trains to Auschwitz left Bonne-la-Hollande and Pithiviers.
Why weren't the Veldiv families sent to Drancy, in the Paris suburbs? Franck Lévy gave a bleak smile.
The Jews without children were sent to Drancy after the roundup. Drancy is close to Paris.
The other camps were more than an hour away, lost in the middle of the quiet Loiret countryside, and it was there, in all discretion, that the French police separated the children from their parents. They could not have done that so easily in Paris. You have read about their brutality, I suppose.
There is not much to read. The bleak smile faded.
You're right. Not much to read. But we know how it happened. I have a couple of books you're welcome to borrow. The children were torn from the mothers, bludgeoned, beaten, drenched with cold water.
My eyes wandered once more over the little faces in the photos. I thought of Zoe, alone, torn from me and Bertrand, alone and hungry and dirty. I shivered.
Those 4,000 Veldiv children were a severe headache for the French authorities, said Franck Lévy. The Nazis had asked for the adults to be deported immediately, not the children. The strict programming of the trains was not to be altered, hence the brutal separation from the mothers in the beginning of August.
And then what happened to those children? I asked.
Their parents were deported from the Loiret camps straight to Auschwitz. The children were left practically alone in horrifying sanitary conditions. Mid-August, the decision from Berlin came through. The children were to be deported as well. However, in order to avoid suspicion, the children were to be sent to Drancy and then on to Poland, mixing with unknown adults from the Drancy camp, so that the public opinion would think these children were not alone, traveling east with their families to some Jewish work reserve.
Franck Lévy paused, looking as I did at the photographs hung along the wall.
When those children arrived in Auschwitz, there was no selection for them, no lining up with the men and the women, no checking to see who was strong, who was sick, who could work, who could not. They were sent directly to the gas chambers.
By the French government, on French buses, on French trains, I added. Maybe it was because I was pregnant, because my hormones had gone awry, or because I hadn't slept, but I suddenly felt devastated. I stared at the photos, stricken. Franck Lévy watched me in silence. Then he got up and put a hand on my shoulder. The girl fell upon the food that was placed in front of her, cramming it into her mouth with slurping noises her mother would have detested. It was heaven. It seemed she had never tasted such savory, delicious soup, such fresh, soft bread, creamy, rich brie cheese, succulent, velvety peaches. Rachel ate more slowly. Glancing across at her, the girl saw that Rachel was pale. Her hands were trembling, her eyes feverish. The elderly couple were bustling about the kitchen, pouring out more potage, filling glasses with fresh water. The girl heard their soft, gentle questions, but could not bring herself to answer them. It was only later, when Genevieve took her and Rachel upstairs for a bath, that she began to talk. She told her about the big place they were all taken to and locked in for days with hardly any water, any food. Then the train ride through the countryside, the camp, and the horrible separation from her parents. And finally, the escape. The old lady listened, nodded, deftly undressing the glassy-eyed Rachel. The girl watched as the bony body emerged, covered with angry red blisters. The old lady shook her head, appalled.
"What have they done to you?" she murmured.
Rachel's eyes barely flickered. The old woman helped Rachel slide into the warm, soapy water. She washed her like the girl's mother used to bathe her little brother. Then Rachel was wrapped up in a large towel and carried into a nearby bed.
Your turn now, said Genevieve, running a fresh bath. What's your name, little one? You never told me.
Circa, said the girl.
What a pretty name, said Genevieve, handing her a clean sponge and the soap.
She noticed the girl was shy about being naked in front of her, so she turned around to let her undress and slip into the water. The girl washed herself carefully, reveling in the hot water. Then she nimbly climbed out of the tub and wrapped herself in a deliciously soft, lavender-scented towel. Genevieve was busy washing the girl's filthy clothes in the large enamel sink. The girl watched her for a while. Then she timidly put her hand on the old lady's plump, round arm.
Madame, could you help me get back to Paris?
The old lady, startled, turned to look at her.
You want to go back to Paris, petite?
The girl began to shake from head to foot. The old woman stared at her, concerned. She left the washing in the sink and toweled her hands dry.
What is it, Circa?
The girl's lips began to tremble.
My little brother, Michel. He is still in the apartment, in Paris. He is locked in a cupboard, in our special hiding place. He has been there since the day the police came to get us. I thought he'd be safe there. I promised to come back and save him.
Genevieve looked down at her with concern, tried to steady her by putting her hands on the bony little shoulders.
Circa, how long has your little brother been in the cupboard?
I don't know,
the girl whispered dully.
I can't remember. I can't remember.
All of a sudden, every ounce of hope she still harbored within her ran out. In the old lady's eyes, she read what she most dreaded. Michel was dead. Dead in the cupboard. She knew. It was too late. She had waited too long. He had not survived. He had not made it. He had died there, all alone, in the dark, with no food and no water. Just the bear and the storybook. And he had trusted her. He had waited. He had probably called out to her, screamed her name again and again.
Circa, Circa, where are you? Where are you?
He was dead. Michel was dead. He was 4 years old, and he was dead because of her. If she had not locked him up that day, he could have been here right now. She could be bathing him now, this instant. She should have watched over him. She should have brought him here to safety. It was her fault. It was all her fault. The girl crumpled to the floor, a broken being. Wave after wave of despair washed over her. Never in her short life had she known such acute pain. She felt Genevieve gather her close, stroke her shorn head, murmur words of comfort. She let herself go, surrendered herself completely to the kind old arms that encircled her. Then she felt the sweet sensation of a soft mattress and clean sheets enveloping her. She fell into a strange, troubled slumber. She awoke early, feeling lost, confused. She could not remember where she was. It had been strange, sleeping in a real bed after all those nights in the barracks. She went to the window. The shutters were slightly ajar, revealing a large, sweet-smelling garden. Hens roamed across the lawn, chased by the playful dog. On a wrought-iron bench, a plump ginger cat slowly licked its paws clean. The girl heard birds singing, a rooster crowing, a nearby cow mooing. It was a sunny, fresh morning. The girl thought she had never seen a lovelier, more peaceful place. The war, the hatred, the horror seemed far away. The garden and the flowers and the trees and all the animals, none of these things could ever be tainted by the evil she had witnessed in the past weeks. She examined the clothes she was wearing, a white nightdress, a little too long for her. She wondered who it belonged to. Maybe the elderly couple had children or grandchildren. She looked around at the spacious room. It was simple but comfortable. There was a bookshelf near the door. She went to look at it. Her favorites were there, Jules Verne, the Comtesse de Ségur. On the fly leaves, a juvenile, scholarly handwriting, Nicolas Dufour. She wondered who he was. She went down the creaking wooden stairs, following the murmur of voices she heard from the kitchen. The house was quiet and welcoming, in a shabby, unceremonious way. Her feet glided over square, wine-red tiles. She glanced into a sunny living room that smelled of beeswax and lavender. A tall grandfather clock ticked solemnly away. She tiptoed toward the kitchen, peeked around the door. There she saw the old couple sitting at the long table, drinking from round blue bowls. They seemed concerned.
"I'm worried about Rachel," Genevieve was saying. "She's running a high fever and not keeping anything down. And her rash, it's nasty, very nasty indeed."
She sighed deeply.
"Oh, the state of these children, Jules. One of them even had lice in her eyelashes."
The girl walked into the room, hesitantly.
"I just wondered," she began.
The old couple looked up at her and smiled.
"Well," beamed the old man, "you are quite a different person this morning, mademoiselle. There's a little pink in those cheeks."
"There was something in my pockets," said the girl.
Genevieve rose. She pointed to a shelf.
"A key and some money, right over here."
The girl went to take the objects, cradling them.
"This is the key to the cupboard," she said in a low voice. "The cupboard Michel is in. Our special hiding place."
Jules and Genevieve exchanged glances.
"I know you think he's dead," said the girl, haltingly. "But I am going back there. I have to know. Maybe someone was able to help him, like you helped me. Maybe he is waiting for me. I must know. I must find out. I can use the money the policeman gave me."
"But how are you going to get to Paris, petite?" asked Jules.
"I will take the train. Surely Paris is not far from here."
Another exchange of glances.
"Circa, we live southeast of Orléans. You walked a very long way with Rachel, but you walked farther away from Paris."
The girl drew herself up. She would go back to Paris, go back to Michel, to see what had happened, no matter what was awaiting her.
"I need to leave," she said firmly. "There are trains from Orléans to Paris, surely. I will leave today."
Genevieve came to her, grasped her hands.
"Circa, here you are safe. You can stay for a while with us. Because this is a farm, we have milk, meat, and eggs. We don't need rationing tickets. You can rest and eat and get better." "Thank you," said the girl. "But I am already better. I need to go back to Paris. You don't have to come with me. I can manage on my own. Just tell me how to get to the station."
Before the old lady could answer, there was a long wail from upstairs. Rachel. They rushed up to her room. Rachel was twisting and turning in pain. Her sheets were drenched with something dark and putrid.
"It's what I feared," whispered Genevieve. "Dysentery. She needs a doctor, fast."
Jules hobbled back down the stairs.
"I'll go to the village, see if Dr. Thévenin is around," he called over his shoulder.
He was back an hour later, puffing on his bicycle. The girl watched him from the kitchen window.
"Old boy's gone," he told his wife. "The house is empty. No one could tell me anything. So I went farther along toward Orléans. I found a youngish fellow, got him to come, but he was a trifle arrogant, said he had more urgent things to look to first."
Genevieve bit her lip.
I hope he comes. Soon.
The doctor did not turn up till later that afternoon. The girl hadn't dared mention Paris again. She sensed Rachel was very ill. Jules and Genevieve were too worried about Rachel to concentrate on her. When they heard the doctor arrive, heralded by the dog's bark, Genevieve turned to the girl, told her to hide fast in the cellar. They didn't know this doctor, she explained quickly. He wasn't their usual one. They had to play it safe. The girl slipped down through the trap door. She sat in the dark, listening to every word from above. She couldn't see the doctor's face, but she didn't like his voice. It was strident, nasal. He kept asking where Rachel was from. Where had they found her? He was insistent, stubborn. Jules' voice remained steady. The girl was the daughter of a neighbor who had gone to Paris for a couple of days. But the girl could tell by the doctor's tone that he didn't believe a word of what Jules was saying. He had a nasty laugh. He kept talking about law and order, about the Maréchal Pétain and a new vision of France, about what the Commandanteur would think of this dark, thin little girl. Finally, she heard the front door bang. Then she heard Jules' voice again. It seemed aghast.
Genevieve, he said, what have we done?
I wanted to ask you something, Monsieur Lévy, something that has nothing to do with my article. He looked at me and went back to sit in his chair.
Of course. Go ahead, please.
I leaned forward over the table. If I gave you an exact address, could you help me trace a family? A family that was arrested in Paris on July 16, 1942?
A Valdi family, he said.
Yes, I said. It's important. He looked at my tired face, my puffy eyes. I felt as if he could read within me, read the new grief I was carrying, read what I knew about the apartment, read everything I was that morning as I sat in front of him.
For the past 40 years, Miss Charmant, I have been tracing every single Jewish person deported from this country between 1941 and 1944. A long and painful process, but a necessary process. Yes, it is possible for me to give you the name of that family. It is all in this computer right here. We can have that name in a couple of seconds. But can you tell me why you want to know about this precise family? Is this merely a journalist's natural curiosity or something else?
I felt my cheeks heat up. It's personal, I said, and not easy to explain. Try, he said. Hesitating at first, I told him about the apartment on the Rue de Saint-Ange, about what Mamet had said, about what my father-in-law had said. Finally, with more fluidity, I told him I couldn't stop thinking about that Jewish family, about who they were and what had happened to them. He listened to me, nodding from time to time. Then he said,
Sometimes, Miss Germont, it's not easy to bring back the past. There are unpleasant surprises. The truth is harder than ignorance.
I nodded. I realize that, I said, but I need to know. He looked back at me, his eyes steady.
I will give you the name. For you to know, and for you only, not for your magazine. May I have your word?
Yes, I replied, struck by his solemnity. He turned to the computer.
Please, the address.
I complied. His fingers flew over the keyboard. The computer gave a little crackle. I felt my heart pound. Then the printer whined, spat out a white sheet of paper. Franck Lévy handed it to me without a word. I read, 26 Rue de Saint-Ange, 75003 Paris. Starzinski. Vladislav, born Warsaw, 1910, arrested July 16, 1942.
Garage, Rue de Bretagne, Valdive, Bonne-la-Rolande. Convoy number 15, August 5, 1942. Rivka, born Okunyev, 1912. Arrested July 16, 1942. Garage, Rue de Bretagne, Valdive, Bonne-la-Rolande. Convoy number 15, August 5, 1942. Sarah, born Paris, 12th arrondissement, 1932. Arrested July 16, 1942. Garage, Rue de Bretagne, Valdive, Bonne-la-Rolande. The printer emitted another whine. A photograph, said Franck Lévy. He looked at it before giving it to me. It was of a 10-year-old girl. I read the caption. June, 1942. Taken at the school on the Rue des Blancs-Manteaux, right next to the Rue de Saint-Ange. The girl had slanted, light-colored eyes. They would have been blue or green, I thought. Shoulder-length pale hair with a bow in it, slightly crooked. A beautiful, shy smile. A heart-shaped face. She was sitting at her school desk, an open book in front of her.